So we're talking about data. I'm very happy to welcome, we have David here from Data Culture Change, who anyone who was here last year will remember. We've got Jamie. Jamie is from the Society of London Theatres and I believe has just come from the UK Theatre Revenue Generation Summit. So we all want your tips on revenue, please. and then we have Jonathan as well from Bot Consulting. I'm not going to do much talking. Each of them has about a 15-minute presentation, and then we'll save questions till the end. So, David first. Off you go.
Hello, everybody. Nice to see lots of you again from last year. I'm going to start with a bit of participation. Question for you. According to the, if I talk into the microphone, it probably helps. According to the 2021-22 Office for National Statistics Family Spending Survey, which of these things was spent more on by households? Toilet paper? Sausages? Newspapers? Or live entertainment, specifically theatres, concerts and shows? And there's a clue in here in terms of the time period, 21-22, so that's from... So it's from the beginning of April 21 to the end of March 22. Hands up for toilet paper. Who's for sausages? Anyone for newspapers? No one for newspapers. And live entertainment? A smattering. Well, you're all right. It was all the same amount. How much do you think that was per week, per household in the UK? Any ideas? Fiver? Higher, lower than fiver? £0.90 a week. I'm going to come back to the survey in a minute. But I'm going to take us to some other data sources as well that are a bit fresher than this in terms of telling the story of what's happening with audiences at the moment. Now, those of you who were in Cheltenham last year will have seen this chart almost identical to this at this point. This is DCMS data. DCMS used to have a survey called the Taking Part Survey, which was a really, really kind of granular survey done face-to-face. They'd done it for 15 years, and just as the pandemic hit, they decided to stop doing it and swap to a different sampling approach called the Participation Survey. Similar, but it's done online instead of in person. And it asks questions in a slightly different way in some places. So what we've got here is theatre, which they used to ask theatre as play, drama, musical, pantomime, ballet, opera, operetta. They asked those separately. They now just ask one question, which kind of covers all theatre. And what we saw up until a year ago was that things were really bad, but they were getting back towards something that was looking similar in terms of numbers to pre-pandemic. And updating that chart for data up until the end of June this year, we're seeing that theatre is back to where it was pre-pandemic on this notion of the proportion of the adult population in England who've been to the theatre in the last year. That doesn't take into account the amount they spent or the number of times they came. They've just been at least once in the last year. But good news there. They did something really strange with festivals when they changed surveys. So in the old Taking Part survey, there were two questions. One was about have you been to a carnival, and have you been to a culturally specific festival? And they changed that in the new survey to a festival and or carnival, music, food, culture. So far broader definition than what they had before. And we were already seeing by this time last year that numbers were up. How have we done in the last year? Not great. It's really plateaued from that point. It was a horrible summer. Last one of these. Street arts. Now, street arts was way down, and it hasn't moved hugely in that period of time. But I think the reason for that, the biggest reason for that, is that they used to say street arts, and then in brackets, an artistic performance that takes place in everyday surroundings like parks, streets, or shopping centres. And I think that probably resonates a lot more with a lot of the public than the term street arts. But again, we're not seeing big positive shifts. Going back to that family spending survey data, I have to confess, I didn't know it existed until a couple of months ago. It's great. It goes back years and years and years. It's really granular. It starts off with a category called recreation and culture. It then splits down into subcategories. The most one that's appropriate to us is recreational and cultural services. But we can see that within recreation and culture, we've got newspapers in there, we've even got package holidays, we've got all sorts. Within recreation and cultural services, as well as cinema, theatre and museums, we've got sports in there, we've got TV subscriptions, we've got gambling in there as well. And then at the most granular level, we have these three things, of which live entertainment, theatre, concerts and shows are one of the three. So it's really... panel can't see anything. It's to do with a mirror. With each of these kind of different layers, they report at different spatial levels, so you only get that really kind of granular data for the United Kingdom. Cinema, theatre and museums we can get at national and regional level. And then kind of household specific categories like age and income, we can only get for that kind of recreation and culture. What we saw in the last data, so for the period up until the end of the last financial year, total average weekly household expenditure, £529 on average across the UK. Going into recreation and culture, just at 11%. Click through these. You can see it getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and there's our 90p again, which is 0.2% of household spent. I don't think that's very big, but that was at that weird period coming out of the pandemic. If we go back to 2012, these are things that were similar to live entertainment at that point. So fruit and veg, juices, berries, women's undergarments, bacon and ham. And between 2012 and 2020, some big changes, and all of these are not adjusted for inflation. These are the figures from the time. But we see that live entertainment was doing well over that period of time. Bacon and ham wasn't. And there we have the impact of the pandemic. And we've been overtaken by berries. But we're still beating bacon and ham. A I've started digging into, okay, so where are the changes coming from? And it's difficult because you're not getting all the data at all the levels. But the two key things which seem to be coming out from this slightly aged data, it's retired people who were really fueling that growth over the last decade that weren't, particularly in this period, and poorer families, families in the kind of 10th decile of wealth. Maybe not surprising, but worth remembering. We do a survey on behalf of 37 theatres and concert halls around the UK on a monthly basis, where we have a tracker to see how they're feeling. It was started off to about COVID and is now more about cost of living. And as part of the cost of living element of this, in November we asked what best describes your household's finances now compared to 2 years ago. And we got a really varied response. Remember, this is a survey of theatre attenders. It's not the whole population, it's just theatre attenders. And the people who are most likely to respond are more frequent and recent bookers. But what we see within this is, actually, more than half of them are not saying they've seen a hit to their household, meaningful hit to their household spending in the last 2 years. And 17% of them are saying they have more disposable income now than they did back then, almost one in five. That's not to say at the other side that there aren't big, big issues. And if we take these two groups, the small group that says, yeah, we got more money than we had before, and the group that said they've got significantly less, and then ask them, okay, what's your outlook? How are you feeling about the next 6 months? Those who've done well, it's looking pretty good. Those who have felt that they've really lost income over that period of time, it's looking pretty awful. Really divided, really polarized. Couple of slides here, which you won't get circulated because it's not published data, and it's a little bit sensitive. This is 237 organisations who provide a daily feed to Purple Seven, theatres, concert halls, even a festival or two is in here, and this is showing compared to 2019. Tickets and revenue. And as of the end of October, so this is very fresh, tickets down 16%, revenue down 8%, without taking into account the rampant inflation we've had since 2019. We're not back to where we were before. To leave you on a high, and I take it coming to an end. Far better news around donations. And this is a smaller sample of 95 organisations. Again, good mix of organisations providing data. I wouldn't look too much at the revenue figure because that gets really skewed by mega gifts. A couple of mega gifts can take it completely crazy, and if you've got a big building project, that can make a difference. The more interesting figure is the number of gifts being given, which is way up on 2019. 26% more gifts being given. I think that's largely because we're asking better than we were before. We're doing it more frequently as part of that purchase flow process, but good news that people are giving. And remember, those 17% who are feeling better off than they were a couple of years ago, we need their help to support those who are feeling really, really bad in the current crisis. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Is there any way I can lift this out so I can move around, or is it fixed? Thank you. I do work in theatre, so I'm a frustrated art actor, so I do like to walk around. So, hello, everybody. My first interactive bit is, can you tell which one's me and which one is the large statue of Laurence Olivier? That's your first question. I work for Society of London Theatre and UK Theatre. Specifically, I head up the Theatre Token Scheme, which is the UK-wide national gift voucher scheme for theatre. My background, though, is festivals. I went to university in Edinburgh. My first summer there, I tore tickets on the Dover Fringe venue, and I ended up being head of ticketing at the Edinburgh International Festival. So whilst everything I'm going to talk about is related to theatre, hopefully you can draw some parallels as well. There's a lot of information here. It will be on the slides. It will be downloaded, so don't worry about trying to take it all down. I'm not going to go through it all. I'm not a data scientist. I'm just repeating things other people have told me that I thought were interesting, specifically from Wednesday when we did do a revenue generation summit. And some ideas came out of that, which I'm going to show you. A lot of data at the start, then hopefully some examples of what you might want to do to look at what you're doing, and then a couple of mini case studies that theatres actually very close to here are doing in terms of pay what you decide and subscription methods, which you might find useful also. I'm going to do something similar to David. People attending might have recovered, but it's very lumpy. And we're going to look at some specific actual box office data as well. I'll try and make it as not dull as I possibly can. First thing to say is, and this is from the audience agency, so the link is there. They gave me full permission to share this. Go to their website. You can download everything I'm going to show you, plus much more as well. 3 years pre-pandemic compared to the last year. And we're looking at plays, dramas, musical theatre, and Christmas shows across a wide variety of theatres across the country. Performances, 23% down. Tickets, 25% down. Income, 17% down. So however you wish to pass that, so one affects the other, we are, as David said, we are not back to where we were pre-pandemic. That is not the situation at all. It does depend on who it is, though. And these are how they categorise people who attend the theatre in the UK. Again, the definition of all of these on the website, you can probably guess what some of them are: metroculturals, commuterland, culture buffs, experience seekers, and so on and so forth. There is a line there, the 100% line. That is where we were pre-pandemic. And as you can see, most categories are not back where we were in terms of tickets. This is not in terms of attendances, this is in terms of tickets. The worst affected, right here in the middle, has collapsed. Home and heritage. That is older, more wealthy, small-c conservative people, possibly the bedrock of certain organisations, audiences. That has collapsed, and that has not come back, as opposed to trips and treats and frontline families. So families, as you'll see in a moment in terms of art forms, families are back to where they were. People that just go occasionally that aren't really that engaged, a bit more mainstream, they've also come back as well. They are where they were beforehand. Everything else is very much a mixed bag. This is also about age group, and it shows you, you can probably work this out in advance, but this is actual data. Younger people, it's still down, but there's more of them attending more often than opposed to 65 or older. You can see 45 to 65 is terrible. 9% attending more often, 51% attending less. And even the best category, the younger people, it's still 21% more, 35% less. So there are varieties in age groups as well, something to take into account when you're looking at things. This is even more depressing if you think about it. So this is the categories broken down by art type. And we're looking at theatre, so we look specifically here, we break down to Christmas shows, musical theatre, plays and drama. Anything challenging, plays and drama, is doing worse than anything mainstream and comfort food, and just isn't it pleasant to go to a panto or a big musical, or I should be so lucky at the Manchester Opera House, which is a wonderful show, isn't it, Jane? You can see again there is differences along, bizarrely, well, I mean, not that bizarrely, metroculturals. Plays and dramas are doing much better, but you'd expect that. That is middle class, that is disposable income, that is engaged with art in large metropolitan areas. People with lower incomes are much more likely to say, I'm not going to plays and drama, I'm going to go to Christmas shows and musical theatre. Again, you can see none of it's good, but there is variety, I think, that is worthwhile being aware of. Again, download all this at your leisure. It's not just coming back from COVID, though, is it? It's now the cost of living crisis. This was split between any arts and heritage in the last 12 months, musical theatre and plays. And again, plays suffer the worst, as you might expect. But the big one here is 73% are worried about the cost of living. 57% of people are put off attending arts and culture because of their concerns about the cost of living crisis. Those are concerning numbers, let's be honest. The cost of living crisis is, it does depend, again, by category. Again, I'm not going to go through this in detail. Have a look at this at your leisure. But as you might expect, the people with more disposable income and the categories that are more engaged with art are less concerned about the cost of living crisis than people with young families and people in lower economic groups. It's pretty obvious, but the data's there so you can actually see it. Remember, the cost of living crisis is not one thing. You've got the interest rate problems with mortgages. You have energy costs. You have the overall inflation of people, what you're buying in your shopping basket. And those different factors affect different groups differently as well. So when you're looking at the people you're targeting, they're being affected in different ways by different things. Don't lump them all in together. That was all quite doom and gloom. That it's not meant to be. There are opportunities hopefully out there. Hopefully we're coming back as well. This was an interesting thing. Spectrix very kindly allowed me to share this with you. They're a company that were at the conference I was at. They work with a lot of theatres, and they've suggested this, and they've done this with a lot of theatres. And we actually did it in the room on Wednesday. I won't do it here because it takes a while. But we did this in the room. Before you are worrying about how we can do other things, how can we do different ticketing promotions, how can we, you know, attack your audiences, just what are you doing right now? Audit what you're doing right now first, to make sure you're actually doing new things in the correct area. So look at your income stream. So look at your ticket income. Do you know how your ticket income is performing against your forecasts and sector trends? Do you know that information? Do you have smart measurable goals for ticket income based on specific audience segments and genres as we just looked at? Do you know who's most likely to book for what show, and what do you send them that's relevant? And do you know when and how you'll know what works? Do you actually have measurables? So do an audit first. Make sure you know what you're doing before you try new things. There is, of course, a downside to this, which, and I think we all know this in the theatre industry, B especially, it's like, well, if we're just going to go with that data, we're going to end up with jukebox musicals, every theatre in the country, and lowest common denominator. As much as I love a jukebox musical, if you follow this to its logical extreme, that's all you'll end up with. So with caution, but audit what you're doing. And not just ticket income. What are you doing with your memberships? What are you doing with subscriptions? What are you doing with your donations? What are you doing with your secondary spend? Look at what you're currently doing and see, do you actually know how it works and what might work better? So their advice, and a lot of theatres have been doing this with them, is know what your priorities are and have clearly defined targets. Know who your audience is. You've got a lot of data from different touch points. Use that data properly. And know what works for you. Set clear targets. You can have the most grandiose plans in the world, but if you don't have the resources, if you don't have the staff, if you don't have the expertise to do it, it's not going to work. You know, tailor what you're trying to do for who you actually have and what you can actually do. It might be useful, it might not be. It's just something that was floated and it seemed to go down well on Wednesday, and we had a lot of lively debate about who was doing what, I'll be honest. But it's not all doom and gloom. Here's two really, really good examples of theatres local to here who are doing really interesting things. Shakespeare North Playhouse is brand new. It's in Prescott near Liverpool. It was opened last year. Its ambition is to be the Globe of the North. It's lovely. It is basically like a scaled-down Shakespeare's Globe. They have a pay-what-you-decide scheme. Decide. Not want, not feel, not can afford. What do you decide? I'm going to read you why they use that word. So I think it's very interesting. I asked their head of audiences, why did you say decide? And this is her answer. Okay. Decide. It's audience-centric language. It places the focus on the audience's autonomy and choice. By using this phrase, It communicates a sense of empowerment to the audience, emphasizing their ability to make decisions based on their preferences and actually what they need. And actually, it's also a true reflection of the experience. Pay what you feel. What you feel might not be an option. You're being presented with a list of parameters. You need to decide one of those parameters. Whether you agree with their logic there or not, that's what they have done, and they feel that it's best than saying feel, or want, or can afford. Just something to think about. In terms of the actual scheme, though, it's done very well indeed. In the period since they opened in July 2022, they've sold 13,000 tickets on the Pay What You Decide scheme, which is approximately 15% of that overall ticket sales. So it's quite a large part of it. What they've actually done, though, is this second bit, which I think is really interesting. Pay What You Decide support. So they've done Pay What You Decide, and what they saw were there were quite a few people that were actually paying more than the face value of the ticket rather than less. And so on the same page, they are saying to people, if you can afford to pay more, rather than doing it that bit, just buy the ticket, but can you help us support this scheme? So can you give us an extra pound, an extra £5, a monthly subscription to help other people who cannot afford their tickets, afford their tickets? It's a bit too early, they said, to actually look at the if that's working as well as they hope, but it is working, and people are donating more than they were before. So it's not just having that scheme, it's having saying, can you support the scheme? And we discussed before about the whole pay it forward concept and that kind of thing as well. So it's very similar, but they're explicitly linking it to supporting this, which I think is quite interesting. The other thing they've done is Pay What You Decide. If you live locally, you're more likely to get it. So they have taken very, very carefully the concept of we have to build our local audience to survive at all as a new venue or new festival, whatever it would be. So when you log in, their system set up that if you have a local postcode, so L34, L35 for Liverpool, you can automatically get access to more seats that are Pay What You Decide than if you were not a local resident. And of all of those Pay What You Decide seats, 43% of them were bought by local residents. So they are very clearly saying we are trying to target local people, and it is quite a deprived area, who potentially cannot afford to pay our standard tickets. But if you can afford to do it, help others as well. Go to their website. It's a really nice website, actually, and it's really clear what they're doing. And also, if anybody's interested, their head of audiences said, I'm free to share her email address if anybody wants to ask them how they do it as well. Then, even closer to home, the Royal Exchange Theatre here in Manchester. This is about subscriptions. So what they used to do, they had a pretty standard season ticket pre-COVID. They have four core shows a season, various add-ons. You have to book it all in advance. You have to decide prices, price bands, weekends, matinees. You had to do it all in advance and book the whole season. COVID hit, they reopened, and their prime focus was just on getting people back in the building. So rather than having the season ticket, they went for a very simple multi-buy option. Literally, buy a ticket, get another show, 25% off, 30% off, whatever it is. Just get you through the door. We know you're not going to come as much as you used to. COVID's happened, get through the door. Now, they think, right, we've got you back through the door. Let's reintroduce the season ticket. But it's not really a season ticket anymore. It's a ticket subscription. But they're still branding it a season ticket so as not to scare their core audience. What it is now, though, it's incredibly simple. There are four shows in their season. And you just simply say, right, wonderful. All you have to do is tick, 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 tick. Your only decision is what price band you want to sit in, nothing else. There is no variety in price if it's a matinee, if it's a weekend. You have to do nothing other than say, I want to sit in price band A, B, or C. That's literally all you have to do. They are trying to encourage people to come to the more popular shows that they know people go to. For example, their Christmas show, which is a musical brief encounter. Sure, why not? But then the show after Christmas is a piece of new writing called Shed that very few people have heard of and would struggle. So they are trying to link everything together, say, it's not going to cost you anymore because we're going to give you a discount. So come and see the really popular stuff, but see the more challenging stuff as well. You're in the building now, it's all easy. The other thing they're doing here as well is you don't actually have to book your tickets right now. You buy your subscription, whereas when you did a season ticket, you had to choose your tickets and book everything in. It's literally, you have booked your subscription. Book the tickets whenever you want. Log into your account on our system. You are tagged. Book it today. book it in 4 weeks, book it in 3 months' time. That leads on to a very, very clever thing they're doing. It's just such an easy customer service win. In 3 months' time, they may have forgotten that they've actually booked for the final show. So they're proactively going out to people saying, don't forget, you've done this. Come along, you know, have a glass of wine on us, that kind of thing. So they are doing a really, really clever customer service piece around that as well. And at the same time, of course, what that's doing, in the theatre industry, people booking are doing it very late. That has changed substantially since pre-COVID. This is tying the income in right now for shows that are 6 months away. So even if they're not choosing the tickets, you as an organisation have the income. It's a very, very clever scheme. And again, they're very friendly. They're very happy to talk to people if you wish about them. I think... There we go. Okay, so any immediate questions? Obviously, we can have questions at the end as well. And we're doing a round table later on ticketing as well. So any immediate questions on any of that?
I had an immediate question.
Yes. Their average ticket price is around £25 to £30 normally, and they are seeing a discount. So they are budgeting for the fact that the 15% of tickets are selling that way on average. They're only going to make maybe 50% of the income. But that's why I said that's what their budget was, and then they were surprised to see that some people, though, were paying more. So they accept there's a budgetary cost to it, but they're also tying in, philanthropy at the same time. So you do need to budget, and that's why they only have a limited number per show. That's why it's not open. You have a limited number per show, and more if you're a local. So they are budgeting that very carefully indeed, absolutely. Absolutely. So they're doing very clever things there, actually. They're doing a really good job. Any other questions? Until the end. Okay, thank you.
Jeremy said he wasn't going to be boring, but I thought that was brilliant. Fantastic. And... not just because we're doing an income generation review with the Anvil Arts in Basingstoke, so you've done that project for me, which is fantastic. And some very good data from David too, a little bit gloomy. And looking, some of it was looking at the period from 2012 onwards, but even further ago, 2008, Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister, financial crisis. It's a very long time ago now, but that was the last time we had Festivals Mean Business. That was Festivals Means Business 3. But now we're here to talk about Festivals Mean Business 4. I'm from Bop Consulting. Jonathan, Chief Economist at Bop Consulting. And good to see faces from Cheltenham last year. So I talked a bit about our work then, so I won't repeat that now. Some projects we've done. Good to see James here from Edinburgh Festivals. That was a big part of my past 12 months. So, Festivals Mean Business 4. We have some clear aims for this research. It's a bit tricky seeing what's actually on the slide from when you're speaking. So, what are four aims? Define the sector. What is an arts festival? Might seem obvious, but if we want to build a data picture, we need to have a clear definition. Engage with the sector. That begins from today, right now. Define the footprint of the sector. So we've got a clear definition. We need to build up a data picture of the sector in terms of what its footprint is now. And David was giving us a picture of evolution and how things have changed. We'll be looking at change over time too. And we'll be developing methodologies to support you do this kind of work in future. Okay, why does this matter? Well, it matters because we haven't done it since 2008, which is an awfully long time ago. So we need to understand the sector's current state. What do we mean by arts festivals and how are they performing? We need to have that understanding of the sector's performance to advocate for the sector and to secure greater support for festival development. So those are external objectives. Also, it will help, we hope, with internal planning and improvement of sector's decision-making and help festivals navigate the future. Now, Jamie, as I said, shared some fantastically useful data more focused on the theatre sector. Hopefully this research will help build up more of a data picture as relates to arts festivals, which will understand where the sector is at the moment, you know, its importance, but also the challenges that the sector faces. So the research itself needs to overcome some challenges to deliver those outcomes. I've already touched on definition. And across all of these 4 points, I'm setting them up as questions, and we might come back to this in the discussion that follows these presentations. Equally, as I'll go on to discuss, there's an advisory board that's been put in place in relation to Festivals Mean Business 4. So we'll be consulting with the advisory board around these challenges, and certainly feel free to grab me afterwards to give me some guidance on any of these questions. So definition is a challenge. That's going to determine what's in scope, what's not in scope. Participation. So, you know, the data that David was sharing was largely, I think, coming through national ONS surveys. And obviously with the resources of the ONS, it's possible to secure participation. We're building this data up through the participation of the festivals themselves. So we need your engagement, and we're interested in how we can make sure that engagement and participation happens as smoothly and effectively as possible. Representativeness. So we need to secure a representative sample of the sector as a whole. The more responses we get, the more likely to have a representative sample. But we do need a way of understanding the underlying population to make sure that our sample is representative, which is a particular challenge. Finally here, the survey. So I've already said we want to make participation as painless and smooth as possible. You know, we recognize the many other challenges on your time that you have, but equally, we want the questions to be deep and meaningful enough to generate useful conclusions. So there's a bit of a trade-off between ease of completion and the kind of depth that we are ideally looking for. So we need a challenge to strike that right balance. This gives us there's a bit more on each of these challenges. Obviously, since 2008, a lot's changed in terms of the digital landscape, remote activities, growth of multi-art camping festivals. This is the definition that Festivals Mean Business 3 used. Short-term scheduled events where the program includes performances and or exhibitions featuring single or multiple art forms. Many arts festivals include opportunities for audiences to participate directly in programmed activities, although this is not always the case. So we might run with that definition again. I think there's scope to make it a bit tighter and also to frame it in a way that we're sure can be replicated within the data. Participation. So obviously about the BAFA conference, but this research is also being run with the Association of Festival Organisers and the Association of Independent Festivals. So we'll be pushing the survey through those three organisations, and we're looking to go beyond those three organisations too. And interested in your thoughts in how we can push this out. I'm going to speak to Fiona about a little comms campaign that we want to do, but good to coordinate that with everything else that's happening in the sector. This is the representativeness challenge that I've already referred to. So we're going to make our sample as big as possible, so we get as many survey responses as we can. But we need to understand the underlying population in terms of arts festivals to ensure that that sample is representative. And here's our, these terms came to me from Fiona, management group, advisory group, partners. So that's me, Jonathan Todd, under Bop Consulting, and other colleagues in relation to the management group. You can see the advisory group there and the partners. Quite a few of these organisations, I'm sure, are in the room. So looking forward to working with you on this. Quite a lot of detail on this slide, but key dates are that over the next 2 months, December and January, we'll be developing the survey, and over February to March, the survey will be live, so look out for that. Hopefully that's a time of year that's as convenient as possible in terms of completing the survey. And this relates to the survey. We'll use an impact framework, thinking about inputs, activities, outputs, outcomes, and impacts to structure the survey, think about what you need, what inputs festivals need to deliver activities, and what outputs, outcomes, and impacts follow from those inputs and activities. So this is a structuring device that will inform the way our survey is structured. But we're very keen to hear from you on what you'd like to see the survey cover. So this will be revised over the next couple of months. And that's all from me.
So thank you, all of you. That was really interesting. I'm just going to open up to questions. Questions? I've got so many microphones. Yeah. I don't know if any of these are working.
I'm not sure if there's a question or an observation, and I do want it also to relate to what Tamara said earlier, because there's so much going on in the world, and even though this is about festivals being business, and we've got data, some of it's negative. Obviously, that line about negativity relates also to the wider world. It's how maybe as part of this BAFA research, we kind of go beyond the economic to try and capture something that's meaningful, that might be of interest for organisers, but also might play into this idea of festival as reconciliation, or festival as bringing people together, and try to address some of these issues that we know are in society, and maybe we are tending to avoid. So I have no idea how the hell you answer that, okay?
Yeah. You made me laugh there, James, saying economics or something more meaningful after the amount of time you and I have spent poring over the Edinburgh Festival's Excel files, trying to pull together the economic impact. But I hear you. There is something more to this, and particularly, as you're saying, relevant to the speaker from the Netherlands. Let's think about how we can incorporate that into our survey.
I don't think I'm going too far outside of the scope of what we've discussed, Fiona, to say that I was listed there in the management group, and we will be thinking about how this FMB4 research integrates with the PhD research that I'm doing. And I think obviously the FMB stuff is very quantitative research, mine's very qualitative research. There's a lot of crossover in what we're sort of thinking about looking at. We'll be defining those survey questions with very much with that sort of thing in mind. So I think the two will work in partnership.
And I was going to say, I had the benefit of being here yesterday afternoon and picking up on the presentations around belonging in festivals. Clearly, there are opportunities, which you've just answered.
Just a quick kind of adjacent point as well. We were looking at the things affecting people returning to the arts. So return from COVID, cost of living crisis. There are other things as well, and I know that, I mean, I made a kind of jokey remark about I should be so lucky here, but I was there last week, and the week before that, they had to stop the show three times, three different nights, because of audience behaviour. And that is something that is actually damaging confidence in people returning to the arts because of the behaviour of the audiences. There is no evidence that people have forgotten how to behave in public arenas, whether it's a school, whether it's anywhere, and shows are being disrupted on a frequent basis now. We get reports from all of the Western shows all the time, and some of the things you're hearing now, which always happened at a very low level, happen all the time now. And that, if you're going to spend a lot of money to go to a piece of art, do anything, and then it's ruined by the audience, you're not going to go back. So that is just something we need, I think, to factor in as well. It's not just all the other factors. It's how people behave and how the behaviour has changed since the pandemic.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. When you were saying about defining arts festivals, which I think is like a perennial challenge, and I was just going to say, when you're trying to do that, also look at academia, because there's so many books, articles, conferences that have grappled with that for probably the last 20 years. So that's a really good starting point.
Well, very grateful for the key references.
Yeah, I can do that.
Hello? Yeah, hi. This is a bit of a plug, but I think it's important to say this. Naomi and I were talking over breakfast. In a different hat, I work for an outdoor arts organisation called the Bureau of Silly Ideas, which is the sensible use of silly. And we have just done some research, and we're working with Goldsmiths to transform how the outdoor arts is monitored in terms of data. And the way we've done this is that we've invented a currency. And this currency is called the currency of smiles, and we are campaigning for it to be in the Treasury Green Book. And it's a very serious piece of work. It really is. And Goldsmiths have got behind it. And the idea is that using anonymous facial recognition data, that there are a certain number of smiles, and these smiles are known through all of this academia that you were just talking about to have certain impacts on the body. And it's a whole bit, I'm not that department, there's a whole science team who are working on this, and it absolutely is true. And what we're doing is we're testing it out next year in a number of festivals where we're putting this, and it can count smiles per second, literally, and it can work out what kind of smiles they are, and from that you're getting some data. So I think that the whole qualitative, what was quantitative and what was qualitative is changing rapidly as we use technology. It's a new project, but I think there's lots of people doing it, but we've just got some funding from Goldsmiths for the next stage. So if you want to get involved in that, you can have one of our monitors. Thank you. That's a bit of a plug.
I thought that sounded very interesting. Yeah, good.
I just wanted to... It's an observation. Quite a lot of the... In the current climate and with a lot of the organisations and festivals we're talking about already established. But I think it's really interesting what's happening here with this organisation and the building that we're sitting in, because not only are they a venue, but they are also the host organisation for a festival. And they're doing some really interesting things in terms of how they bring people in. Because as a new venue, how do you get people into you? So they have a fascinating scheme where there are tickets for most of the things that they run for £10. And it's run on an honesty scheme. So the Danny Boyle show, Free Your Mind, was the opening show here. There were tickets for every performance at £10. And certainly when I came and saw it, it was a very interesting mixed audience, much more so than you see. And I'll mention it again, if you go and see I Should Be So Lucky, Jamie, or any of the other big musicals at, you know, in venues around the country. But they are also looking at how they, if they're audience members that might have more disposable income. So they have a range of membership schemes with various kind of benefits. So I just, it's just a very interesting thing as a kind of a multi-use venue and a multi-art form organisation.
And there was a question over in the far corner as well. Just
on the subject of ticket pricing and pay what you decide. I personally, I'm a huge believer in accessible ticket prices. You should have an accessible ticket price. If you're doing everything at one price, why? You've got people who could be paying more, and you're excluding people who are paying less. I've never known a pay what you decide scheme last in the long term. They for the last 30 years, we've tried it, and they've kind of creaked on and toppled over after a while. But affordable ticket prices, constant messaging, always tickets available at X pounds, book early. That's the way to go.
Yeah, 2 points there, absolutely. Pay what you say can be a short-term panacea, basically. And I think what Shakespeare North are doing is, because they are a brand new venue, this is why they're doing it. They're trying to build that local audience, and I suspect you're right, it will fade away over the next few years. But whilst they're still trying to build an audience and trying to tell people this is who we are, this is where we are, that's why they're doing it, I think, as well. Accessibility and pricing is a massive thing, which I'm not getting in touch, we might talk about it later in the ticketing roundtable, but it's true. And you, for example, you had yesterday Dominic West in the press again saying West End theatre ticket prices are too high. That's incredibly unhelpful to the theatre industry, because yes, the top prices are very high. There are people that can afford that. With the greatest respect, there are people that can afford that and are happy to pay it because they have the best seats. So let them, and let them subsidise the people that can't afford it. The promises he's talking about, £250, £300 top price, there are still seats for £10, £20 in the auditorium for each of those performances. If you can afford it, don't discount everything. Let people pay big prices if they want to and can afford to.
That's told Dominic West.
Yeah. I've got two questions. My first question is, on the behaviour that you've seen shift, where you've got disruptions, is there a particular reason? Has anybody identified? Is it because of a different audience coming into those venues now with lower income tickets or membership, different membership schemes? Or is it something to do with alcoholic behaviours that have shifted in the pandemic?
It's very complex. There has been the stuff of some research into this. There is a lot of working theory around the fact that during the pandemic, people forgot how to behave in public. And so we were so unused to socialising and so used to being in our rooms that we forget that when we speak, if you're watching Netflix, they can't hear you. But if you're in a theatre or anywhere, they can, and it's disruptive. So there was an article yesterday about schools. You know, kids have forgotten how to socialise. You know, that's a wider societal issue, not just what we're facing, but we are facing it.
Yeah, so my second question is, I think being somebody who doesn't drink for faith and cultural reasons, alcohol, I find festivals really inaccessible because of the copious amounts of alcohol that you've just mentioned. And even when you come into certain environments and spaces where I know there are, as festivals, theatre shows, are inaccessible to certain groups and communities who are Jewish, Muslim, Sikh, and also of non-faith now, where even vegans are now anti-alcohol. So those kinds of environments, I've not seen shift, because if anything, I've seen it go the other way. And since the pandemic, this city in particular has got a problem on its hands with the nighttime economy being so difficult to control and manage, and it's not really in the public eye. But there's an unprecedented amount of alcohol being consumed in the city, and the amount of F&B that's offered in the city alongside festivals is all alcohol orientated. And I don't see how that data is going to improve, where every time I'm around the table or in an event or in a meeting, diversity and inclusion and data and metrics is always being talked about, when the actual data and definition and accommodation for audiences that come from different cultural backgrounds isn't changing. Metrocultural isn't a definition in my Asian culture. It's not a definition. Like it's a systemic problem that's come from decade to decade. And I don't think, having even sat in the cultural strategy meeting roundtable exercise that they had last week at the City Council. It's the same questions coming up 2 decades later. I joined this sector 2 decades ago as a total naive person coming to try and make a difference. And I believe I have, but the wider challenges, the bigger policy, the bigger data, the definitions, the terminologies and how people are identified hasn't changed. It still seems elitist, still seems very exclusive. And you can see it. You can see it where whichever festival, whether it's Park Life, Glastonbury, local festivals, there's small change, but the accommodation, unless you have got the gravitas, the money, and the resource, it's just not possible. And in a shrinking economy where everybody's fighting for the same money, I think it's becoming impossible. So how does it change? I guess is a question. Sorry, I didn't mean to rant at the same time, but you know, something's got to change somewhere. Data, definition, audience demographics, what we want genuinely, authentically. I think I'm all for smiles, but like I said last week, like we're in a serious, you know, we're in a serious business. I don't think it's just about business. I think business is important, but culture, arts, festivals can be life-changing experiences in how people see eye to eye. And it's a societal change, you know, like you're saying that a pandemic can affect people, but people coming together, taking arts and festivals seriously, it's an educational process. Cultures thrived in civilizations based on these serious things that were not fun and fluffy, as some people like to define us. So I think with the serious data that's being done, there's an opportunity here to make some serious change if we're looking at the next decade and how we're going to make people feel more included.
I couldn't agree more. My company's called Data Culture Change for a reason. We have data, but we're looking at a cultural sector that is inequitable now as it was 20 or 30 years ago, and things desperately need to change. I think there's a market opportunity there. I think you're absolutely right, people aren't being served. And your festival, which I think is next September, I'll be going along, and I'm sure lots of other people will too.
I think challenges of inclusion and participation were actually touched upon in the data that David and Jeremy both presented. And, you know, less participation from less affluent people, unfortunately. But we're constrained by the structure of the data, aren't we? I think that was also a theme of David's presentation, what we can get out of the ONS data. I think the ONS data has many strengths, actually, but equally, one of its limitations is you're constrained by its structure. As we're designing the survey for Festival's Mean Business Work, we're not limited by those constraints. We can explore the issues as we think are relevant. And you made some very good points about things that we should be including in that survey. I've had 3 logistical challenges. I couldn't see the slides. Then my pen ran out, and now I'm in a position where I can't take notes. But I'll try to remember everything that's been said. It was by the various contributors, and take some notes afterwards.
This is actually a very, very small point, but it goes back to what you were saying about the prevalence of alcohol in the arts and in festivals. And this happened in Edinburgh this week. Joyce McMullen. The writer, she went to the Traverse, and the Traverse is a very, I think it would regard itself as a very, very progressive theatre, very, very inclusive, etc., etc., etc. And she went to the bar and asked for a cup of tea 2 hours before the show, and the show started at 7:30. I was like, no, we stopped serving soft drinks at 5. I was like, so she didn't have a choice. She could either have water or alcohol. Hot drinks, oh yes. So yeah, tea or coffee, so... Yeah, she wanted tea or coffee, whichever one it was. I was like, we don't serve that after 5 o'clock. So, but I don't drink alcohol. I want a cup of tea. So and that kind of thing is, it's a small thing, but it's not a great example of being inclusive.
It's the way that the economic model, both for festivals and for venues, that a significant income stream is the F&B. Yep. And, you know, you can make big profits on that. And people now, when they're building it in, so it'll be really interesting when you get the responses from the survey where that leads, because I think there's a certain onus on the organisers and the promoters as well in, you know, in terms of how you bring people in, how you push alcohol or whatever, because it is such an important part now of the economy of the arts.
I think the thing that travels, not to be kind of travels, but I think besides the same issue, and I asked for the coffee and said no, there's no it's a wide issue around staff. It's around staff shortages. It takes much time to make a coffee than it does to give you a Coke. So it's not just about that, it's about staffing, which is a really
So, I mean, this is why there's so many other things. That's why I mentioned audience behaviour. But you're right, staffing is something else we should talk about. I mean, every single theatre I visit has vacancies. They cannot fill staff in any department. So you're right, that is part of it as well. There are so many different moving parts of this, absolutely, that we need to take into account.
Yes, thank you. What I was really interested in is the audience behaviour and that how that correlates. I did some research in 2008. My background is in site-specific theatre for the last 30 years, but I also direct opera, so I work in across two fields as a freelancer. And one of the things that I've noticed is how younger people and some audiences have their first engagement with art. And a lot of that now is interactive. It's, you know, in Manchester, it was the Streets Ahead Festival, which was fabulous 15 years ago. And that generated a new kind of audience that was interactive. But I do think alcohol has got a big part to play in it. And then the development of festivals in the last 10 to 15 years has grown exponentially, where that is a very different environment. So therefore, perhaps somebody going to a theatre, a traditional building-based experience for the first time, their reaction is very different. So although the pandemic has played a part, I think it's a change of audience perception and behaviours as well. That they, you know, when I was young, you could go to the theatre from school, and a lot of that has stopped. So those behaviours are not being inbuilt, if you like, from a younger age. Or, you know, 20 to 30 somethings now, there's a little bit of research that says that they're looking for an immersive and a different kind of experience. They want something that they feel they can be a part of, rather than being a passive observer of a production like a musical or a play. They don't want to watch Pinter, they want to go and watch Black Antler or something like that, where they can, you know, it's an immersive and a very different experience. So I think the demographics of audience experience has changed significantly in the last 15 years. It's not just socialisation with the pandemic.
There is a very interesting argument, stroke discretion, says that if new audiences are coming in who don't know theatre and don't know how to behave in theatre, that they should be educated in how to behave in theatre. But the opposite of that is, why should we be doing that? Shouldn't we be learning from them? They're coming to the theatre, they're the new demographic, so why don't we learn what people want to how they want to behave here, rather than trying to enforce a norm that is potentially past its sell-by date. So there are people on both sides of that argument, but whilst we are having that argument, we are getting shows disrupted and stopped, basically. So it's a tricky one, it really is.
Can I just a note of caution in terms of anybody leaving thinking that don't go to a theatre because it's going to be chaos in there? We did it as part of our ongoing survey with those 37 venues. We asked questions around what's your experience, what's annoying you when you go to the theatre. Very, very, very few performances are being impacted by this. What annoys people when they go to the theatre? It's mobile phones, top of the list. And then, yes, alcohol is an issue for some people. It's an issue for some people that there's too much drink, and that it's an issue for others that it's hard to get a drink and they're expensive.
I'm just absolutely, to clarify, I mean, my job is to promote the theatre industry, so I'm saying you should definitely not go to the theatre. But it is very, most theatres around this country, you're absolutely right. Most performances will be absolutely fine. There are just certain areas that, especially with the great expense, because it's the one that makes the most money, commercial West End, so it's back to alcohol. So much alcohol, Friday, Saturday nights, they're the ones that are most likely to be disrupted, absolutely.
I just want to say another big thank you to our panellists, but before we do that, just please do engage with FMB4 when the surveys come around and when the further information comes out. It's really, really important for the sector. It's how we get the information that allows us to lobby on behalf of the sector to government, to the various other agencies that we need support from. So the more you contribute and the more you can share it with other festivals, the more impactful it's going to be. So thank you. Carry on talking over coffee. There's coffee through there. And I think we're back in half an hour. Fab. Thank you.